Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
It's good to be with you again, Ian.
And Saudi Arabia has threatened to blockade its neighbor Qatar by land and sea unless it cuts ties with the Muslim Brotherhood, closes down Al Jazeera, and expels the local branches of two U.S. think tanks, the Brookings Doha Center and RAND Corporation's Qatar Policy Institute. Those are fighting words, aren't they?
Well, they certainly are. This is an escalation, and it's a provocation seemingly out of nowhere. It's not unprecedented that Saudi Arabia has had tense relations with Doha, but this seems to be an escalation.
So they've got the rest of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, also ganging up on Qatar, as of course is Egypt. So this has got to be a very lonely position for the new young leader of Qatar.
Well, right. I mean, Bahrain is essentially a satellite of Saudi Arabia, so they don't follow an independent line in any event. That the Emirates have supported the Saudis in all of this reflects a certain ideological proximity and hostility toward Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular. It is important, and Egypt kind of at the moment serves a similar role, a kind of dependency or satellite to the Saudis, the Egyptian military regime, which, remember, toppled the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in coming to power. It's also largely dependent on Saudi largesse at this point. But the Omanis have certainly not towed the line. There is not consensus within the GCC about how to handle everything all the time, although there seems to be at least a small group of countries willing to follow Saudi Arabia's line here.
Well, the Saudis, of course, are heavily backing the Egyptian regime, which just deposed the Muslim Brotherhood, which was heavily backed by Qatar and supported with a lot of propaganda and news coverage, positive news coverage by Al Jazeera, not necessarily by the English version, which we see over here, but certainly by the Arab language version. My sense is that the Saudis seem to be taking on this massive burden of the Sisi government. Sisi, of course, the military leader in Egypt, who's likely to be the next president. I mean, they're talking about billions and billions that they're going to be needing. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have spent $32 billion so far with no end in sight. So walk us through what's going on here, both with Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
So I think there are two things to keep in mind, very generally, and one you put your finger on, and that is that Saudi Arabia is feeling somewhat muscular in the Arab world and in the Gulf as well, and including its extensions. Part of this, part of Saudi Arabia's regional geopolitics is about confronting Iran, but the other part of it is also about consolidating Riyadh's primacy in the Arab world itself. There have been contests historically between Cairo, some of the other republican regimes, as well as the monarchies in the Gulf. In the 21st century, the Saudis aspire to a position of supremacy, and they've put that on display over the last few years, right? As the region seems to have kind of veered toward the precipice and back, the Saudis were anxious in 2011 as the uprisings began to take shape. But as they've developed or petered out in some cases, the Saudis have sought to consolidate gains in Arab capitals across the region. And they have all kinds of reasons to want to do so. For the most part, it's a good old-fashioned balance of power pursuit of regional primacy. It's not ideological. It's about sustaining and buffering Saudi power in the region. There's also a political economic component to this, and that the Saudis, of course, they benefit in massive ways economically by being the most powerful actor, right? They can control energy markets. They can dictate prices. They can spread their wealth around. And they can also generate wealth by investing in these places as they rebuild and tap back in to Western networks of finance, et cetera. The other part of it is, and I think this is also on display, although it's not obvious, with the particular turn against the Muslim Brotherhood. So frustrations with Qatar have to do, yes, with Qatar's respect for and support for the Brotherhood, not only in Egypt, but also for Islamists in Syria. There's a kind of popular confusion about how Saudi Arabia thinks about its power in the world. Is it an Islamic state? Is it driven by ideology? Is Wahhabism a useful way to think about it? And I don't think any of those things necessarily rise to the level. And that's the first thing that Saudi policymakers think about. In fact, they view Islamists, in spite of the kind of social contract they have with clerics in their own country, with a great deal of suspicion. And they have a good reason to do so. The Muslim Brotherhood, when it fled Egypt in the 1960s and 1950s, many of its key members sought refuge inside Saudi Arabia. And over the course of the 1960s and 1970s, those Muslim brothers who took up positions in Saudi institutions began targeting the Saudis themselves, calling for an Islamic government, criticizing the al-Saud. So the Saudis feel like they've been burned historically by the Muslim Brotherhood. They see them both as a threat in the region to a kind of secular political arrangement, and they see them as a threat at home as the most important ideological force that could undermine their credibility in Riyadh itself.
And, of course, the ultimate product of the Muslim Brotherhood militant theology was Osama bin Laden, in the sense he and Zawahiri came out of the Qutb school, did they not? I mean,
Certainly Zawahiri did, yes. I think that's generally true in the sense that its development, its internal developments at a particularly fraught moment in Egypt in the 1960s, mm-hmm. that the jihadist strain of the Muslim Brotherhood began to take shape, mostly in Egyptian prisons. So to the extent that the Muslim Brotherhood helped, you know, generate this radicalization, then yes, we can situate Osama bin Laden within that community. But bin Laden was not a Muslim brother. I mean, we don't want to buy into Saudi Arabia's language that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization.
Sure.
But there are all kinds of connections. Yes.
Well, he certainly got disgusted with the regime and threw his passport in the king's face. Again, I'm speaking with Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. So you've got what seems to be going on here is that this conflict with between the Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council in Egypt and Qatar is mirroring a larger Middle Eastern struggle over systems of governance that have been playing out across the regions since the Arab Spring. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you do have this generational gulf, do you not, between the 89-year-old Saudi king versus the 33-year-old new prince or king, I guess, of Qatar.
Well, outwardly, it seems that the generational difference should matter. One of the things I'm very cautious about, in as much as we can make sense of these kind of particular kinds of regional and local struggles, and we can talk with some certainty about political ambition. One thing we can't do, it's very difficult to access, kind of peel back the Saudi and the Qatari version of criminology. And we don't know exactly what's driving this hostility at this particular moment. I mean, there are contradictions at work here that don't seem to have anything to do with generational difference. I mean, for example, this is a sudden turn. The Saudis had not only declared a kind of at least a rhetorical war on Qatar. They've also changed some of their own domestic laws around the Muslim Brotherhood. They've criminalized the Brotherhood. There have been a series of arrests recently, both in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And they've also threatened to impose heavy fines on any Saudi citizens who go and participate in the jihad abroad. And this is a pretty sudden transformation, given that we know the Saudis have actively been supporting those very networks in Syria, for example. So what exactly is driving this at this particular moment is hard to say. I wouldn't chalk too much of it up to a difference of generational perspective. It seems that the Saudis have some kind of logic at work, that they think they stand to gain in some way by doing this right now. And I'm not sure what it is.
Well, I can't see what they'll gain from closing down the Brookings Doha Center and RAND Corporation's Qatar Policy Institute on the eve of President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia at the end of the month. I mean, what is their reasoning? Have they said why they want to close down these two Washington think tanks?
This wouldn't be the first time that Washington, that American-based or that European-based think tanks would have been shuttered in the region. And certainly Saudi Arabia has a long history of cracking down on journalism, journalists, and those of us who have done think tank type work there. Bahrain, for example, has closed down several offices, as have the Egyptians. We know about Freedom House and Cairo's crackdown on them several years ago. And I think if I had to make sense of the Brookings and RAND are not arms or extensions of the Muslim Brotherhood. So on the one hand, it doesn't seem like it would be an extension of that particular approach to regional politics, right? This isn't about Islamism. But both of those places have come out and been consistently critical of both American reluctance to promote or support democratic transitions in the region, and they've been very critical of the kind of deeply entrenched nature of autocracy and authoritarianism, especially in the Persian Gulf. So that's a little too close to home for the Saudis. And Brookings is probably the more visible of the two. At its heart, I think what Saudi Arabia worries about more than anything, and again, keeping in mind that they want to protect both their position in the region, but also the legitimacy and the primacy of the El Saud at home, is they worry about influential networks that are transnational, that speak in a language of human rights and democracy that might somehow appeal inside the region. Now, in saying that, I think the Saudis probably overestimate the actual influence of Brookings and RAND inside Saudi Arabia itself. But if you can shut down all avenues of expression, then I think the Saudis would aspire to that.
Well, it's an awful government. I mean, it's the most medieval government on the planet, I think. There's only a king. There's no parliament. You're entirely subject to the largesse of the king. It's a young population that has access to the outside world in terms of information. So they're riding a tiger, aren't they?
Oh, they absolutely are for all kinds of reasons. I mean, look, I agree fundamentally that this is a terrible place. Now, it's managed to mobilize an incredible PR regime, and it's got powerful supporters inside the United States, inside Britain and elsewhere, many of whom profit from the arms industry and from other kinds of connections. But there's also a kind of misperception, I think, amongst influential American foreign policy thinkers in particular, who think that Saudi Arabia is a relatively moderate, liberal place. This is a coercive, violent regime that brutally stamps out expression. It cracks down and crushes minorities. It imposes a strict system of gender apartheid. And this is not a happy or a friendly government. I mean, the Saudis are fascinating, and they're mixed, and it's heterogeneous, and it's culturally rich, and it's a wonderful place to spend time. But it's a brutal government.
So then they're fighting against the tide of history, aren't they?
Well, I mean, they've hung on for quite a long time. I mean, as a historian,
well, they got a lot of money, right?
They do have a lot of money. I mean, look, I mean, the other part of this, the tiger part, right? I mean, where things could spin out of control. I don't think it's necessarily going to be along ideological lines. I don't think the Islamists are going to rise up and throw the El Saud out of power. But we haven't talked about this. I mean, the Saudis have all kinds of reasons to worry about their medium to long-term health, their political health. This is a place that's dependent on energy entirely for its political economy. They have to maintain high prices, but high prices enable all kinds of consuming countries to think about alternative forms of energy. The Saudis can't guarantee their own financial or economic security, say, over the next two decades. If oil becomes less important to the global economy, then the Saudis face a number of really potentially pressing political problems, the most important of which is they won't be able to generate the kind of revenue that they need to continue to buy off the opposition and those at home who don't like them.
Well, in terms of what the Egyptians are requiring from Qatar, I mean, you've got the Saudis threatening to blockade, right? And that's wouldn't that seriously shut down the country? I mean, its only border is with Saudi Arabia, isn't it, Qatar?
Yeah, I don't think this is a serious threat. I mean, I think this, and we don't know for sure that it's actually been issued in a way that that makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of reporting going on, and there's certainly a lot of rumor mongering. But I don't know how credibly we should take Saudi Arabia's, kind of grandstanding that it can isolate Qatar in the region. I mean, look, the Saudis don't have, I often sit in rooms with people who want to think about Saudi Arabia's ability to project its own power. There's a reason that the Saudis remain dependent on the United States for its security assurances, and that's because the Saudis are basically ineffective militarily. They've been defeated consistently by a group of ragtag rebels in North Yemen. So how successfully could they really impose some kind of a blockade or embargo on Qatar? I don't think that would be particularly effective. But rhetorically, it's meant to raise concern and to try to compel Qatar to fall back into line. What's interesting is that Doha has refused to do so far.
Well, apparently these threats were made by the Saudi foreign minister, Saud bin Faisal, in a foreign minister's meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council in Riyadh last week. But there's been no follow-up, I take it. There's been no military deployments, and not like Putin threatening Ukraine.
Not that I know of. No. I would be shocked. Foreign ministers' meetings are great places for lots of heated rhetoric, finger pointing, and for venting some frustration. And certainly, the Saudis wanted to make a point. But I would be the first to beg forgiveness from those folks who watch if the Saudis either on the one hand really intended to follow through with such a thing, and on the other, if they could actually do it. Because I don't think either is realizable.
And from the point of view of the demands being made by Egypt on Qatar, I mean, they've put a bunch of Al Jazeera people on trial in Cairo, and they're demanding the extradition of this prominent Islamic cleric, Yusuf Karadawi, I should say, who's widely seen as a spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's in Doha, and apparently he appears regularly on Al Jazeera, criticizing Egypt's military government as well as its Saudi and backers in the Gulf.
Yeah, Karadawi has a long history of being influential on Al Jazeera. He's been a central feature of their satellite programming for more than a decade. And he is one of the most visible Muslim Brotherhood figures in the Arab world, and certainly has poked at the Saudis in the past, as well as the secular, or at least the non-Islamist political leadership in Egypt over time. The Egyptian part of this is really interesting, right? So Sisi's coming to power, and he's apparently poised to run for president. And to attempt to, in many ways, reinvigorate the military presidential tradition in Egypt. But a Sisi-headed government will not be like a Mubarak-headed regime. It's far from clear that Sisi has either a clear vision or the capacity to create a viable economy in Egypt. Egypt remains terribly vulnerable. And there's also, of course, revolutionary memory, and there's all kinds of reasons to think that Egyptians and that the Egyptian revolutionary movement is not over. So it's with this in mind, I think, that Sisi is doing all that he can do to appeal to his paymasters in Riyadh by framing both his domestic and regional policies in ways that reflect Saudi Arabia's anxieties, probably more than his own. And I think this explains, for example, why Egypt withdrew its own ambassador from Doha, but also why there are these kind of theatrical, cartoonish characteristics to how Egypt is managing its own domestic political situation. I mean, it really borders on the absurd, and it's unsustainable.
So do you think that the Saudis, at the end of the day, are going to just waste a lot of money on Egypt? I mean, you're saying earlier that they've got power, they've got money, they throw their weight around. They're essentially taking on an economic basket case with a general
right.
who's not ever going to be popular with his people. The Americans right. aren't comfortable dealing with him, even though they have this longstanding deal going back to Camp David. He's toying with, getting the Russians to supply him with military aid. I don't see him as a viable leader for Egypt over the long term.
No, I agree completely. I think this is a mad, desperate gamble that's driven by a lot of urgency in the moment. I would be surprised if the Saudis had actually thought this through, or Sisi for that matter, about what the long-term implications are going to be. I don't think it's sustainable. I think it's going to become increasingly expensive. The Saudis can't afford to continue to subsidize sclerotic, failing, aging, corrupt regimes around the region. They can barely sustain their own, which has similar dynamics. I think this is a ticking time bomb for lots of folks, not only heads of state and those who seek to keep power, but also for those who oppose them. My view is that the Saudis are encouraging and invigorating the worst pathological and dangerous forces across the region. And they, too, may pay a price. But I'm pretty sure that even outside of Saudi Arabia, there will be a heavy price to pay.
So the message here is that even though it sounds alarming that Saudi Arabia is threatening to blockade its neighbor Qatar by land and sea unless it cuts ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, closes Al Jazeera, and expels the U.S. think tanks, Brookings and Rand Corporation's think tanks there, this is not going to end up as much of a crisis. That's the message you're giving us, right? Other people are alarmed by it, but you're not alarmed.
Well, I don't think that the GCC rift, I don't think that the Saudi spat with Doha is the most significant angle here. I mean, I think the other regional dimensions, the way that this particular conflict, for example, papers over or directs our attention away from the very thing that we just talked about with respect to the sustainability of Egypt's political order, which is vulnerable and, in a very dangerous place. Those are more pressing issues, and Saudi Arabia's influence there is more important than a contest over whether or not Al Jazeera is going to broadcast members of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a fight the Saudis have been having with Qatar for a long time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Toby Jones.
Ian, good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, as Professor of History at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle Eastern Project. And from 2004 to 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.